KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Why is the government of El Salvador continuing to imprison a man where they have no evidence he's committed any crime and they've not been provided any evidence from the United States that he's committed a crime?
Maryland Senator Chris Van Hollen goes to El Salvador but is blocked from meeting Kilmer Abrego Garcia, the Maryland father sent to the notorious SECAT mega prison in an administrative error. Meanwhile, a constitutional crisis is emerging as a judge finds probable cause to hold the Trump administration in criminal contempt for its willful disregard of his order to stop the first flights of immigrants to El Salvador last month. We'll get the latest. Then to Sudan.
As we enter our third year of war in Sudan, our hopes are about to evaporate before our eyes, especially after the massacre of Zamzam Camp, the largest IDP camp in Sudan, and where my family have lived for nearly 20 years. If we don't act now, we'll be facing the Al-Fashir massacre.
We'll speak with Darfurian refugee Emmy Mahmoud and Jan Egeland, head of the Norwegian Refugee Council. He's also just back from a trip to the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, where President Trump is hoping to cut a mineral deal. And finally, one day, everyone will have always been against this. We'll speak with award-winning author Omar El-Ahed, whose new book is out about the war on Gaza. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. District Judge James Bobisburg said Wednesday he has probable cause to hold the Trump administration in criminal contempt of court over its willful disregard of his order last month to halt flights transferring immigration detainees from the U.S. to the notorious SECAT mega prison in El Salvador. Judge Bobisburg noted Trump officials have since failed to rectify or explain their actions, giving the administration 1 week until April 23rd to respond. On Wednesday, Maryland Senator Chris Van Hollen traveled to El Salvador but was blocked from meeting with Kilmer Abrego Garcia, a Maryland father who was sent to the mega prison on the March flights in what the Department of Homeland Security has admitted was an administrative error. Both the Trump administration and the government of President Nayib Bukele has refused to release and return Abrego Garcia. Senator Van Hollen spoke to reporters in San Salvador after meeting with the Salvadoran vice president.
I'm asking President Bukele, under his authority as president of El Salvador, to do the right thing and allow Mr. Abrego Garcia to walk out of a prison, a man who's charged with no crime, convicted of no crime, and who was illegally abducted from the United States.
Senator Van Hollen said the vice president of Salvador told him the country would keep Abrego Garcia locked up since the U.S. government is paying El Salvador to do so. The senator also said more members of Congress are planning to visit El Salvador soon. Van Hollen's visit came as Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth welcomed El Salvador's defense minister to the Pentagon. After headlines, we'll be joined by Vince Warren of the Center for Constitutional Rights for more on the story. Meanwhile, Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents are continuing to carry out violent raids and arrests across the United States. Videos emerge showing ICE agents smashing a car window and forcibly removing a man this week in New Bedford, Massachusetts, even after he explained to officers he was not the person they'd been looking for and that he was waiting for his lawyer to arrive. Juan Francisco Mendez is a 29-year-old father from Guatemala, who's currently in the midst of immigration proceedings to finalize his asylum status in the United States. In California, faith leaders and community members gathered Wednesday to protest Trump's plans to turn the notorious, now-shuttered Dublin women's prison, dubbed the Rape Club, into an ICE detention center. This is Reverend Deborah Lee.
He's trying to get billions of dollars to go towards the Department of Homeland Security for ICE operations, to move people, to arrest people, to detain people, and to deport people. We all know that this will make our communities more unsafe. And we know that he cannot deport people without detention beds, which is why this place is so important that we not allow more detention beds to open up here in Northern California.
The IRS is reportedly considering revoking Harvard's tax-exempt status in retaliation for Harvard refusing to collaborate with the Trump administration over its demands related to DEI and criminalizing free expression. The Trump administration has already moved to block over $2 billion in federal funds for Harvard. The Justice Department suing the state of Maine after it refused to comply with a Trump administration order banning trans athletes in school sports. This is U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi.
The state of Maine is discriminating against women by failing to protect women in women's sports. We are seeking to have the titles returned to the young women who rightfully won these sports. And we are also considering whether to retroactively pull all the funding that they have received for not complying in the past.
Maine's governor, Janet Mills, responded in a statement, quote, "This is not just about who can compete on the athletic field. This is about whether a president can force compliance with his will without regard for the rule of law that governs our nation. I believe he cannot," Governor Mills wrote. Israel's military has stepped up a series of deadly strikes on tent encampments for displaced Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, as the United Nations warns Israel's renewed assault has uprooted about 500,000 people since Israel shattered the ceasefire in March. Earlier today, an Israeli airstrike targeted tents in the Jabalia refugee camp, killing at least 7 people. Separately, 10 Palestinians were killed in an overnight attack on a tent encampment in Khan Yunis, with children among the dead and wounded.
A 12-year-old disabled child. He burned to death in his wheelchair. We carried him. Even his bones had melted as we pulled him out. This is the child's wheelchair. A child, 12 years old.
Palestinians are marking the annual Prisoners' Day holiday with marches demanding the release of political prisoners. Rights groups say there are nearly 10,000 Palestinians currently held in Israeli jails. 400 of them are children. More than a third are being held without charge under Israel's so-called administrative detention policy. On Wednesday, a lawyer for the jail director of Gaza's Kamel Edwin Hospital, Dr. Hussam Abu Safiya, said his client had experienced beatings, mistreatment, and torture inside Israel's notorious Ofer prison. The lawyer, who was last able to visit Dr. Abu Safiya on March 19th, said, quote, "He's suffering greatly. He's exhausted from the torture, the pressure, and the humiliation he's endured to force him to confess to acts he did not commit," unquote. Bloomberg News is reporting U.S. officials are in talks with pro-government militias in Yemen about a possible ground offensive to oust Houthi fighters from the Red Sea coast. U.S. aerial attacks on Yemen since mid-March have killed at least 123 people as Houthis vow to continue targeting ships in the region that are tied to Israel's war on Gaza. Last week, a group of Democratic lawmakers called on the Trump administration to halt its attacks on Yemen, citing the War Powers Resolution, which requires congressional approval or a declaration of war to directly attack another country. Protests against Israel's assault on Gaza continue. Over the weekend, tens of thousands of people marched through the Pakistani city of Karachi in solidarity with Palestinians. On Wednesday, police in Berlin violently arrested Palestinian solidarity protesters in front of Humboldt University. That followed similar scenes in the Netherlands on Monday when Dutch police used batons to beat protesters who'd occupied a campus building to demand the University of Amsterdam cut ties with Israeli institutions. In Britain, police arrested 2 people Wednesday as they held a protest on the roof of a factory that supplies hardware to Israel's biggest weapons producer, Elbit Systems. The activists reportedly sabotaged parts inside the Grid Defense Systems factory before climbing to the rooftop and unfurling a banner reading, "Grid and Elbit, blood on your hands."
Are just regular people who oppose genocide, who oppose companies on UK land selling weapons that are used to kill children. In the past month alone, we have seen babies with no heads, children's bodies blown apart.
Bodies, dead weight, literally flying from the sky from how powerful these bombs are that are obliterating entire neighborhoods. We cannot stand back and just do nothing.
In Kentucky, prosecutors are asking a Louisville judge to silence any discussion of genocide or Israel's assault on Palestinians ahead of the June trial of five activists who were arrested last year as they blocked entrances to plants operated by Raytheon and BAE Systems, which supply weapons to the Israeli military. The motion also seeks to bar defendants from wearing Palestinian keffiyehs and from holding protests in the vicinity of the courthouse. In Sudan, the Rapid Support Forces paramilitary group has declared the formation of a rival government as Sudan enters its third year of a devastating civil war that spawned the world's largest humanitarian crisis. The conflict showing no signs of ending after high-level meetings in London collapsed this week, and the Sudanese army remains engaged in bloody battles with the RSF. At least 300 people were killed in displacement camps over the weekend in the war-ravaged western Darfur region. We'll have more on Sudan later in the broadcast. Human Rights Watch is warning the Tunisian government has turned arbitrary detention into, quote, a cornerstone of its repressive policy, unquote, as President Kais Saied continues to crack down on his opponents and critics. This comes amidst a mass trial against dozens of people, including prominent politicians and media figures who the Saied government has accused of plotting against the state. Last week, six detained opposition figures launched a hunger strike while hundreds of protesters took the streets of Tunis.
It's tyranny in every sense of the word. No freedom of opinion, no freedom of expression, no freedom of action. Over the smallest thing, a person finds themselves in prison. Even what I'm saying now could get me arrested and jailed tomorrow. This is reality. I'm not making this up.
In Colombia, indigenous leader Eric Anderson Menzapavi was shot and killed in the southwest Cauca region on Saturday. He's at least the third indigenous community leader to be killed in the region this year. Rights groups warn the survival of the indigenous Nasa people are at heightened risk amidst the systematic attacks. Back here in the United States, California is suing to block President Trump's tariffs, which it says are illegal and economically destructive. This is California Attorney General Rob Bonta.
Trump has had to resort to creating bogus national emergencies that defy reason. He's even claimed there's an influx of illegal immigration and illicit drugs crossing over the Canadian border as the basis for imposing across-the-board tariffs on Canada. It is completely untrue.
In other trade news, President Trump claimed big progress was made in tariff negotiations with Japan after Trump unexpectedly joined the preliminary talks Wednesday. Meanwhile, Italy's far-right Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni is at the White House today, where she's expected to defend European trade interests as she meets with Trump. Here in New York, two white prison officers were charged with second-degree murder over the killing last month of Masaya Nantwi, a black 22-year-old prisoner who died at the Mid-State Correctional Facility after being viciously beaten by guards. Another eight officers were charged with related offenses in the fatal beating, which took place during a prison guard wildcat strike. And in Puerto Rico, the Luma Energy Corporation says it could take up to 3 days to restore electricity after the island's energy grid collapsed Wednesday, plunging the entire island, plunging Puerto Rico into darkness for the second time in 4 months. It's the latest in a series of blackouts since Puerto Rico privatized its electrical grid in the wake of Hurricane Maria in 2017. Puerto Ricans pay some of the highest electricity rates in the U.S. despite frequent outages. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. We begin today's show with the emerging constitutional crisis, as U.S. District Court Judge James Boasberg said Wednesday he found, quote, probable cause to hold the Trump administration in criminal contempt after its willful disregard of his order last month to halt flights transferring immigration detainees from the U.S. to El Salvador, where they ended up at the notorious CECOT mega prison. Judge Boasberg noted in his order yesterday, Trump officials have since, quote, failed to rectify or explain their actions. Boasberg has given the administration 1 week, that is, until April 23rd, to respond. In his 46-page ruling, Boasberg recounted what happened when he directed officials to stop the planes from being sent to El Salvador, writing in part, quote, "By mid-Sunday morning, the picture of what had happened the previous night came into clearer focus. It appeared that the government had transferred members of the plaintiff class into El Salvador's custody hours after this court's injunction prohibited their deportation under the proclamation. Worse, boasts by defendants intimated that they had defied the court's order deliberately and gleefully. The Secretary of State, for instance, retweeted a post in which, above a news headline noting this court's order to return the flights to the United States, the president of El Salvador wrote, quote, oopsie, too late.
And the U.S. Secretary of State retweeted the Salvadoran president. The legal escalation came as Maryland Senator Chris Van Hollen traveled to El Salvador but was blocked from seeing or speaking to Kilmar Abrego Garcia, a Maryland father who was sent to the mega prison in El Salvador on the March flights and what Homeland Security has admitted was an administrative error. Both the Trump administration and the government of President Nayib Bukele have refused to release and return Abrego Garcia. Senator Van Hollen spoke to reporters in San Salvador yesterday after meeting with the Salvadoran vice president.
The Trump administration is clearly in violation of American court orders. Why is the government of El Salvador continuing to imprison a man where they have no evidence he's committed any crime, and they've not been provided any evidence from the United States that he's committed a crime? President Trump and our Attorney General Pam Bondi and the Vice President of the United States are lying when they say that Abrego Garcia has been charged with a crime or is part of MS-13. That is a lie.
Senator Van Hollen said El Salvador's vice president told him that they would keep Abrego Garcia locked up since the U.S. government is paying his country to do so. The senator also said more members of Congress are planning to visit El Salvador soon. Van Hollen's visit came as Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth welcomed El Salvador's defense minister to the Pentagon. For more, we're joined by Vince Warren, Executive Director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. So, Vince, we've got these two situations, both clearly leading up to, if we're not already in, a constitutional crisis. You have the judge in Kilmar's case demanding evidence that the Trump administration is working to get him home, facilitating. And you've got Judge Boasberg saying he is about to find Trump officials in criminal contempt. Explain, start there, and what this is all about. Not civil contempt, criminal contempt. The next key date is next Wednesday, April 23rd.
Yeah, thank you, Amy. We actually are in a situation now where we have two federal judges that are demanding information about the government's actions in deporting people. And that's a normal exercise. What is not normal here is that the government is providing no information, not even the most basic factual information about what's been happening. So the criminal contempt stems from Judge Boasberg's finding that because the government has apparently deported, sent men to El Salvador after the judge's order, rather that they were in El Salvador after the judge's order and they could have been brought back. He's saying that this was done willfully, and you know, putting that in English, what willfully means is that you did it on purpose, you knew what you were doing, and you actually didn't care. And that is punishable by criminal contempt. What's interesting here is that the Supreme Court also, as your viewers know, found that it essentially disbanded this big TRO that Judge Boasberg did. But Judge Boasberg is saying, look, there was a judicial order from this court saying turn the planes around, and you did not do it. You didn't give us a reason why you didn't do it. You posted oopsie and thumbed your nose at the judge. We can't have a situation where the administration just doesn't care what the federal courts say about what they do.
Well, who would be responsible? I mean, if there is, presumably because, as you said, it's criminal contempt, someone would be responsible for carrying out that punishment. But that something would be the Department of Justice, which is itself responsible or answerable to the Trump White House.
Yeah, this is where it gets really, really messy, Nermeen. So The court has a number of options, and one of the options is to refer the case to the Justice Department upon a finding of probable cause, and the Justice Department should prosecute. I don't think that Pam Bondi is going to prosecute anything. So that's one problem. Another problem is that the judge will say, well, I will appoint a judge to prosecute this case if the Department of Justice won't. That can move forward, but it does require people being brought in before the court to be able to face those charges. And of course, the entity that actually apprehends people to bring them to the court is the U.S. Marshals, which is under the purview of what? Yeah. the executive branch. So essentially, there are three opportunities for the court, for the Trump administration to thumb their nose. Number one, they can say, no, we're not going to prosecute. Number two, they can order the marshals not to apprehend people. Number three, even if it goes forward, that the president can still issue a pardon. So what we're talking about here is a constitutional crisis that is going to be made real only by the inaction and the refusal to comply with the law by the Trump administration.
And what kind of explanation would be sufficient, do you think, by a week from now on the 23rd? What would the Trump administration need to provide?
Well, there are two things that I think that are important for this. Number one is that they need to provide real-time information about their attempts to comply with the judge's order during that time. Judge, we tried to do this. We asked so-and-so to not send the so-and-so, and that's not one thing. Another thing that they can actually do is that they can reassert jurisdiction and custody over the people that are in El Salvador, meaning that they do have the ability, being in U.S. custody, even in El Salvador, to be able to comply with the court's orders, particularly with respect to giving hearings to the men who they've transferred. The irony of this whole thing is that what Judge Boasberg is doing, it's providing the government with the same type of due process in terms of criminal contempt that the government refuses to give to the men that they have sent to El Salvador. So due process apparently only works one way, and they will demand due process in these hearings for their government officials, but they will not give it to the people that they're sending
over. So one way that the White House could cure this is just sending the men back on the plane, right? I think that the judge has made that clear. The other way is to explain who is responsible next Wednesday. And these two cases are related because one of the men on those flights was Kilmard. Can you talk about the significance of the Maryland senator? Kilmar's from Maryland. He's Salvadoran, fled gang violence in Salvador, came to Maryland, and there he's lived for many years. But also, while they talk about Kilmar, there's no evidence that he is guilty of any crime. It makes it sound like the other hundreds of men are. You've got the front page of the New York Times today, actually, labeled alien enemies and banished with little or no evidence. The hundreds of men, a number of them can be in the same situation as Kilmar. Now, we've got the judiciary, we've got the executive branch, and we've got the legislative branch. That's Maryland Senator Van Hollen. He can't get an answer. And we watched President Trump sitting with Salvador's president, Bukele. He didn't turn to him and say, I want Kilmar returned. No one doubts for a minute that if President Trump ordered that, he would be returned immediately.
Exactly. That situation with the two presidents sitting there like, oh, bro, what are we going to do? Was outrageous. And, you know, I will tell you that if I were in any place in the world and there was a warrant for my arrest to come back to the United States, they would have me back in 45 minutes. So they're saying, oh, there's nothing we can do. It's outrageous. It's ridiculous. It's wrong. It's a lie. And I think the significance of Congress people going down to CECOT to demand to see the people that are there, that are in their jurisdiction or from their jurisdiction, is really key. I would also note that the El Salvador president has no problem having Republicans come down. They can do, you know, beauty pageants in front of CECOT with Kristi Noem and have Republicans go in, but you can't. They're not allowing the Democrats to go in. That's, you know, that's pure politics, and it's actually messing up the way that the judicial branch and the executive branch and legislative branch should be working to solve this problem.
Do we have proof that Kilmar is even alive?
I've not heard information on that at all.
No one has spoken to him, apparently.
And that's why it's important for lawyers and for people to be able to come down and see them and to talk with them, because anything could have happened. They could be tortured. They could be dead. They could have medical emergencies. And so it's not just an empty political exercise to be able to go down to talk to people. This is sort of core human rights work. You have to lay eyes on human beings to figure out what's happening to them and what conditions that they're in, and then you go from there.
Well, I mean, could you talk, Vince, also about the way in which all of these different law firms, the entire legal foundation of the U.S., they're such key institutions that are capitulating to Trump, one after the other. What do you think, what are the effects of that likely to be as Trump continues all of these extra legal measures and invoking the 1798 Alien Enemies Act to do what he's doing in the first place?
I talk to people in law firms and I say, you have to understand that you right now, law firms, are the biggest tool in building an authoritarian regime. Because everybody knows the first thing they do is they go after the judiciary, they go after the legislative branch, they go after the lawyers, they go after civil society, they go after universities. This has happened in every country in which there's been an authoritarian regime. And here the lawyers are capitulating, the law firms, I should say, are capitulating. And they're creating a tremendous opportunity for one, for us to not be able to vindicate the rights of the people that are being taken. But number two, in these shady deals that they have, they're agreeing to provide billions of dollars of free legal advice to the Trump administration. And you know doggone well that the Trump administration is not going to allow these law firms that used to be with us representing the victims to now represent the victims. They're only going to represent the perpetrators, which is the Trump administration.
I mean, this is very important that Trump has demanded, and a number have acceded to, or several have acceded to, $100 million worth to law firms in this case of pro bono work for the causes that Trump cares about. But what isn't said is that then they probably will not represent pro bono people like those that you work with these law firms to represent. And I was wondering if I could ask you about the one case that you have just joined, Center for Constitutional Rights, in filing an amended habeas corpus petition on behalf of another person taken to CECOT. That's Erickson David Cantero Chacon. Who is he?
So we filed this case because we have a number of clients that are in immigration detention right now and that need to be protected against moving forward. We're very concerned that the larger case is being sort of obstructed by the fact that these people are being moved. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to secure for as many people as we can the right to be able to have their immigration cases done fully and done completely. We're trying to avoid the context that was happening in the Garcia case, where they just rush people off. And the judges and the lawyers are saying, you shouldn't take this person because they're not who you're saying that they are. And we're trying to be able to put plants in the or flags in the ground in a number of places in order to make sure that doesn't happen to future people.
I want to thank you very much for being with us. Your final comment, lawyer, deeply concerned about what's taking place, what you are most watching out for right now.
What I'm watching out for, and I think what we should be concerned about, really are two things overall in the Trump legal fights. And that is, number one, I'm concerned that the courts will capitulate and that the courts will, that other federal judges will allow the Trump administration to get away with what they're trying to do. And the other thing that I'm concerned about is, even if the courts don't capitulate, if they do issue these orders, I'm very concerned that the Trump administration will say, yeah, oopsie, we don't really care.
Vince Warren, Executive Director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Next up, Sudan is facing the world's largest humanitarian crisis as it enters its third year of a devastating civil war. We'll speak with a Darfurian refugee and with the head of the Norwegian Refugee Council, both about Sudan and also the DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo. Stay with us.
By you, found a clue. Don't fix
song by Viva Dubi featuring Claddo. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We turn now to Sudan, which is facing the world's largest humanitarian crisis as it enters its third year of a devastating civil war between the Sudanese army and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF. Tens of thousands have died and some 13 million have been forcibly displaced. There are also widespread reports of sexual and ethnically motivated violence and a worsening hunger crisis. On Tuesday, officials from 20 countries gathered in London at a high-level international conference chaired by the UK, the EU, and African Union to find a pathway to peace. But talks have reportedly collapsed. In Sudan's western Darfur region, the UN reports attacks by the RSF last weekend killed at least 300 people in refugee camps as paramilitaries took control of the Zamzam camp, which had housed some 500,000 people. The NGO Relief International said 9 employees, the entire staff of the camp's only remaining health clinic, were killed in the attack, along with at least 100 others, including children. Some 400,000 additional people are believed to have been displaced in the area just over the last few days.
We're joined now by two guests. In Oslo, Jan Egeland is with us, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, and Emithal Mahmoud, a Sudanese-American world champion slam poet from Darfur, in Philadelphia, born in Khartoum. She's also a humanitarian activist and former refugee. Her new piece for DevEx is headlined in Sudan, "The Power Must Go to Its People, Not to the People in Power." We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Emmy Mahmoud, describe what's happening in Darfur. Describe what's happening in Sudan, as at this point, we enter the third year of this civil war between the paramilitary forces and the government.
Thank you so much for having us. It's so harrowing to describe. My family have lived in Zamzam camp, which is now completely destroyed, for almost 20 years. And the other half of my family is from Al-Fashir, which is now has been under siege for almost over a year. And what's so terrifying about what happened is that an IDP camp is an internally displaced person camp. This is supposed to be a place of refuge. But on Sunday and in the days before, the RSF brutally attacked the camp, killing more than 400 people by our count on the ground. They tortured and killed women and children, and they kidnapped 58 of the girls in my extended family, and we are still searching for them. We cannot find them. We have not seen them since Sunday. This brutality is something that we've seen during the Darfur genocide, and we've seen over and over again in this war and in many of the years from the start of this of the genocide and counting. I think that entering the third year of war, we should not be terrified and confused about whether or not the international community is going to act to stop the Al-Fashir massacre from happening. We warned that the Zamzam massacre would be happening because the MSF reported a child dies every 2 hours from the man-made famine due to the siege. And now we're warning that the Al-Fashir massacre will happen as we actively try to evacuate people. Aid is in huge shortage, and we're not able to move international aid into Al-Fashir, or we were not able to move it into Zamzam either because the RSF will not let it pass. So currently, we're doing everything that we can through small donors and family members and community to continue moving our people who have now been 4 times displaced, including my family members, many who have been killed and many who are still missing. And the injured are bleeding out without any care. So we're moving as fast as we can, but we need the world to pay attention.
Emmy, we're so sorry for the suffering of your family and your family members who have been killed in this horrific war. If you could just kind of give us a quick sense of, you know, how was this 2 years ago? How and why did this war begin between the government forces and the RSF? What's at stake?
Thank you for the question. The RSF is the Rapid Support Forces, and it's the latest iteration of the Janjaweed who terrorized Darfur for decades. And the SAF is the Sudanese Armed Forces. Now, the Sudanese Armed Forces created the Janjaweed and institutionalized the RSF under Bashir, the former dictator. So in 2018 and 2019, there was a lot of movement by the youth, including a lot of us from Darfur who walked for 1,000 kilometers, mobilizing thousands across the way and reaching Khartoum to inspire a collective responsibility for peace. Just a couple months after our peace walk in 2018, I was in Sudan to do it all over again in December, and that's when the revolution started. Now, the revolution was a peaceful revolution led by young people, led by women, and people called for an end to more than 30 years of dictatorship and horrible, horrible genocides, plural, including what happened in South Sudan in 21-year civil war. So in 2019, the world was very inspired, and people said blue for Sudan, and the people in Khartoum said, العنصر المغرور كل البلد دارفور, which means you racist, you hypocrite, the entire country is Darfur. So they heard our cry, and that was to the dictator. In 2019, the dictator fell, and there was a moment of hope, but you know, there were these massacres of young people. They were sitting with sit-ins and peacefully just trying to push for democracy, which is something that we've all hoped for and prayed for, and that's something that's part of our culture. We're very democratic as indigenous people in Sudan and in Sudan in general. And then in 2019, hundreds were killed and thrown into the Nile, hundreds of children and young people in Khartoum who, I say children, but they were young people who were pushing. And I do say children because my cousin Mohammed, he was 15 years old when he was killed in January in 2019 at the beginning of the revolution. So many people were killed and thrown in the Nile. Many are still missing. So then in 2021, the RSF and the SAF cooperated to overthrow the civilian transition. So a civilian transitionary government was put in place with a deal that would be, you know, it would spend 3 years, and in the first couple of years, the military would be in power, which us young people said, do not make this deal. Do not cooperate with SAF and RSF, who are both liable for genocide in Darfur and other regions. But they did cooperate, and then in 2021, RSF and SAF cooperated for a coup that overthrew the civilian government and any hope for a peaceful transition. And then now in 2023, 2 years ago, right as we were getting ready for Eid Ramadan, the massacre began. This war is not a civil war, according to people on the ground. It is a war against the people because we do not consent to this war. So to make it very simple, you have two warring parties who used to cooperate to commit genocide and to, you know, massacre our people. And now they fell out and are having this power struggle. And they're trying desperately to cling on to power. And they're being funded by many nations, rich nations, on both sides. And I say this as somebody who thinks that there should be zero tolerance for genocide. I understand that right now the RSF is the biggest danger for us in Darfur and all over the country. They've used sexual violence as a weapon of war. And the UNICEF reports that 12 million people are at risk of gender-based violence, and they're often repeatedly subjected to the same thing. And they've created man-made famine, they've laid siege, they've done so many different things that are acts that constitute war crimes. The SAF has done the same. But the reality is the RSF and the SAF, they both need to be held accountable to stop this war, and their funders need to be held accountable too.
Well, we'd like to bring in Jan Egeland, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council. Jan, you've also said that this is the darkest hour for Sudan. If you could talk about the worsening humanitarian crisis in the midst of this horrific war and how much worse that humanitarian crisis has been made by cuts in U.S. aid funding as well as among EU donors.
It is by far the worst displacement crisis in the world. 15 million people now displaced by violence. I've been there twice now during this last 2 years of war, and you see devastation everywhere, really. But we are many groups on the ground. Norwegian Refugee Council is in West Darfur and North Darfur and South Darfur, where in Tawila, to where people now flee from the Samsam camp. We try to provide as much relief as we can. But indeed, aid is scarce. And it's beyond me that when I was in the UN in 2003, I mean, 22 years ago, during the first Darfur crisis, this was on the agenda of President Bush of the United States, Prime Minister Blair of the United Kingdom, of the European Commission. We did not lack funding, and we could scale up with a large aid operation. Today, many more are displaced than at that time. More people starve, and there is silence, really, and little funding. The U.S. being the largest historically to Sudan, suspended all aid to to all countries on the 20th of January, including to us and in Sudan. Now we hope we will get back at least some of it, hopefully most of it, but there were months with no pipeline for Darfur and Sudan.
Well, we also want to ask Jan Egeland, since you've recently returned from the Democratic Republic of Congo, you know, what the situation on the ground there is. President Trump's senior advisor for Africa has just finished a tour of several East African nations, including the Democratic Republic of Congo, DRC, where he discussed a peace deal that could involve the U.S. tapping its rich mineral resources in the war-torn east of the country, including cobalt and lithium. This is Massad Boulous speaking last weekend in Kigali, Rwanda, which neighbors the DRC.
I can confirm and I can affirm that the United States also remains committed to this effort and is ready to facilitate an end to the conflict. Obviously, a peaceful end to this conflict. An end that allows countries to secure their borders and lays the foundation for a thriving regional economy.
Rwanda has long been accused of propping up M23 fighters who've been steadily advancing in eastern DRC, exacerbating an already catastrophic humanitarian situation. Over 7,000 people have been killed since the start of the year, over 1 million others forcibly displaced. Jan Egeland, as Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, you just recently returned from the eastern DRC. If you can end this conversation by talking about the gravity of the situation there and what needs to happen as the U.S. once again, a kind of reprise of a very shameful history, is working on a mineral deal with the DRC.
The Democratic Republic of Congo has been in turmoil, in fighting now for more than a generation, and especially in the eastern part of the country. And it has also, like Sudan, had a lot of attention in the past. Now, neglect, really. I was in Goma, which is the capital of the eastern part of DRC and the provinces of Kivu, fully under control of this rebel group, the M23. They have taken not only Goma, which was more than 2 million people, but also Bukavu, more than a million people in South Kivu. Paradoxically, by them controlling the whole area, people can now return home. So for the first time in my many years of traveling to eastern Congo, many people had returned home, 1.8 million. I met them in four communities where the Norwegian Refugee Council is helping them reintegrate on their ancestral land. We will give them seeds. We will help them with farming and with education and with water again. They're happy to be back. But 1.2 million others were displaced by the recent fighting when M23 took this territory from the central government army. So I hope the U.S. will really do two things: resume being the largest aid provider to the Democratic Republic of Congo. Many of the aid organizations are dependent from 50 to 100% of their aid operations on the U.S. And when everything is cut overnight, of course, it has a devastating impact. And even now, when we could help people home and we could solve some of the problems. And the minerals, yes, I mean, these people are among the poorest in the world. They're among the most abused, and they live on top of the incredible mineral riches that have been plundered by so many companies, so many colonial powers, so many of the neighbors of DRC. I hope the U.S. will really make sure that there is an equitable deal that can benefit the people, but that can only happen if there is a peace agreement, and that has to involve the central government, the Rwanda, neighboring country, Uganda, Burundi, and the largest rebel groups, including M23.
Jan Egeland, I want to thank you for being with us, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, and Emtithel Mahmoud, the Darfurian refugee, Sudanese American poet and humanitarian activist, former refugee. We will link to your piece as well. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, one day everyone will have been against this. We'll speak with the award-winning author Omar El-Akhed. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
One day, everyone will have always been against this. That's the title of the new book by award-winning author and journalist Omar El-Akhed. The book is a powerful reckoning with the West amidst its monumental moral failures as the war on Gaza has unfolded.
Omar El-Akhed is also the author of two novels, the most recent titled What Strange Paradise. He's joining us now from Portland, Oregon. Omar, welcome to Democracy Now! This is a powerful, poetic, probing work. And why don't we start with that title? One day, everyone will have always been against this. Explain what you mean.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. I was thinking this was in late October of 2023. I was thinking about how I fit into this part of the world. I've been sort of attuned to the West from a very young age. I grew up on the culture of this part of the world. It's the reason I sound the way I do. And I was trying to figure out how I fit into this part of the world, given that it's my tax money that's killing those Palestinian kids, that I'm doing this. And I was thinking in terms of pattern recognition. I was thinking in terms of how it's very difficult to find someone today who will tell you that they were always in support of South African apartheid or segregation in this country, and how once it's safe enough, everyone can go back in hindsight and talk about how awful the awful thing was. And a lot of the book is about that, is about trying to think in those terms when you're still in the moment where the horrible thing is happening, where the slaughter is happening. And so the book comes out of that, and it's in large part trying to figure out my place in a society and in an ordering of the world where I happen to live on the launching side of the missiles. And as a result, it's very, very easy for me to look away. And what happens when you decide you're not going to look away?
Well, Omar, you also say that the book is, quote, this is taken your words, this is an account of a fracture, you say about the book, a breaking away from the notion that the polite Western liberal ever stood for anything at all. If you could elaborate on what you mean by that and what Western liberal you have in mind?
To be perfectly honest, I mean, I have a previous version of myself in mind. I know I don't think there's a single thing in this book that is indicted or interrogated or autopsied in which I'm not personally complicit or haven't been at a certain point in my life. I mean, look, to be perfectly honest with you, for the majority of my time living in this country, I was very much one of those people who picked up the ballot and looked at who has the R next to their name and then voted for whoever had the D next to their name because, hey, lesser of two evils. And that's, I suppose, perfectly fine up until a point. Up until a point where you are waking up every morning, opening up your computer, and witnessing evidence of the worst things human beings can do to one another, and then being told, again, by the lesser of two evils, that this is necessary and that this is good. And I think at a certain point, there comes a kind of fracture. And look, I spent the last 2.5 months on the road doing the book tour for this book. And we had these massive audiences. And look, I draw about 5 people to my book events on average. I am not that guy. I don't draw hundreds of people. Most of your viewers have no idea who I am. It wasn't because of the book. It wasn't because of me. I think it's because a lot of people in this country and in the West in general have spent the last 1.5 years feeling like they're losing their minds, being told repeatedly that this grotesque atrocity after atrocity is something that they have to support, and that if they don't, they're the bad guys. And I think there's a kind of disconnect that eventually causes you to sever from this idea of, well, I'll just be the centrist and I'll vote for the lesser of two evils and so on and so forth. That works up until a point. And I think over the last 1.5 years, that's sort of fallen apart. And there's a lot of people who are deeply uncertain about where they stand now, given that they can no longer maintain this sort of veneer of centrism or mainstream liberalism that has failed so spectacularly time and time again.
Yeah, Omar, we'll definitely go back to that point because it's something that you also present very beautifully in the book, the demand for a kind of dissociation, which, as you say, in your own case, became at a certain point impossible to sustain, the contradiction. But if we could talk a little bit more about your own genealogy, the book is, of course, about this massive failure of the West, the kind of... discomfort is too light a word, almost insanity that this split has produced in many people, including yourself, as you said, in on the one hand, seeing every day the worst, as you said, that humanity can do to one another, to humans can do to one another in Gaza, and at the same time hearing statements that either deny that something like that is happening at all or say that what's happening is absolutely essential to happen. You intersperse stories of your own childhood growing up, born in Egypt, raised in Qatar, until you moved to the West. Explain where you see your own story and how you've come to think of this, how that's important.
So when I was about 5 years old, my father had to get out of Egypt. The political situation was really bad. The economic situation was really bad. And we ended up in Qatar in the Middle East. And that's where I grew up. That's where I spent sort of my teenage years. And one of the things about growing up in a place like Qatar is that essentially all culture is censored to some degree. You know, the first time I watched Titanic, it was about 1 hour long and very poorly edited and took me a long time to realize that this had actually been sort of chopped to pieces by the government censors, you know, that sort of thing. And when you grow up in that kind of environment, the projection of what you need the other place to be becomes really, really important. And so my first thoughts about what the West is, what the United States is, aren't so much about what the place is as what it isn't. And so I can go there and these movies won't be censored, the music won't be censored. I can be left alone, I can go to the library and pick out whatever book I want. And so you project what you need to be, what you need the place to be, onto the place. And that's how I first thought of the West. And I think for a long time, that's enough for me. One of the issues about finally coming to this part of the world, which I did when I was 16 years old, is that you then have to contend with what it actually is. And I think the reason I end up writing a book like this about this part of the world, as opposed to, say, about Egypt, is because I'm not criticizing something because I love to sit around and criticize. And I get all of the responses that have been essentially one version or another of, well, go back where you came from. I get that. I've been getting that for most of my life. But there is, to me, a sense of there being something worth saving here, of there being something really, really important, and that the avenue towards saving it and towards salvaging it cannot come independent of criticism, because I grew up in a place where that was the case. And I can tell you that complete abolishing of criticism accomplishes exactly what you think, which is nothing at all. And so to me, the reason to write something like this in the first place is because I know what it looks like when you excise all criticism and all dissent from a society. I know exactly what that looks like, and it is a terrifying thing.
Omar, I wanted to end on a specific point on Palestinian journalists. You write about the rightful indignation of the capture of Evan Gershkovich in Russia and the world renunciation of that. He was held for about a year and a half. But then you talk about the comparison to the response to the deaths of Palestinian journalists when you say, when every last Palestinian journalist has been killed, maybe there'll never have been any Palestinian journalists at all. Talk about the response in both cases.
So I was a journalist. It's the only real job I've ever had. I was a journalist for 10 years, and I don't say anything I'm about to say in terms of trying to just blanket criticize the institution of journalism. I have immense respect for the vast majority of journalists. There's a chapter in the book about fear and about the idea of what that word means. Because one morning I woke up and I found an audio recording of a Palestinian girl begging for her life before the car she was in was shot at least 355 times by Israeli soldiers. And then I read a column from a columnist who was scared about protesters at college campuses. And I can't use the word fear to describe both of those situations. If that word can be used to encompass the entirety of that spectrum, that word has no meaning at all. And the reason I bring this up is because the same is true of journalism. I am watching Palestinian journalists give their lives to report this information. And they are the sole source of news about what is happening in a killing field. And then I'm watching columnists and I'm watching reporters on this side of the planet essentially pretend that those folks don't exist because, hey, it's controversial and who knows, and maybe they're linked to Hamas and whatever. And I can't use the word journalism to describe all of that. I need a different word, because right now, while I am watching such fundamental failures of journalism, I'm also watching some of the best examples of journalism in the world. And again, we go back to this idea of the disconnect, the dissociation, the chasm between two things. And for me, that's what it comes down to, is what does that word mean? Because it's describing two very different things right now.
And we're going to talk more about that in part two of our discussion, and we're going to post it online at democracynow.org. Omar El-Akhed is a journalist and award-winning author. His new book is just out. It's called One Day, Everyone Will Have Always Been Against This. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Us on the bus, riding on power through the power. When the passengers make room, whisper bright and groom, that's us on a bus. Two in one seat, love on every detour. You can be sure that I'll show you how it feels to honeymoon on wheels with two in one seat. Slow down, Route 27 is the nearest thing to heaven I know. Speed up! Start hitting 60 and my heart'll jump and thump. Oh, oh, what a bump. Us on a bus, kisses intimating that we're waiting till it's time to light the lamps. Hit the tourist camps, that's us.